Welcome to Copper Country Today. We are heard Sunday mornings at 7 o'clock on 97.7 The Wolf, 8 o'clock on AM 1400 WCCY, and 9 o'clock on KBAR 102.3, our program brought to you in part by the members of the Copper Country Education Association and by the Copper Country Veterinary Clinic, providing the highest quality in medical care to help their patients live longer and healthier lives. You can also listen to a podcast of our program by going to the Copper Country Today page at KeweenawReport.com. Now, in the second portion of the program this morning, Sam Ali will be talking with the producers of the movie Superior, which has been filming here in our area. And in the first portion of the program, I welcome in Jamie Fitzpatrick, who is the president and CEO of Michigan Virtual University, which I had not heard of until very recently. But Jamie, welcome to the program. I appreciate your time this morning.
Oh, thanks for having us.
I had not heard of Michigan Virtual University until recently, but you've been around for a while, haven't you?
Yeah, Todd, we actually got started in 1998, and in the early days we were focused on delivering online education and training to people who were already in the workforce, and then we did some early work to help Michigan colleges and universities get into online learning. We trained a lot of college and university faculty on how to design, develop, and teach in an online environment. And then we were asked by the governor and the legislature back in 2000 to create a supplemental virtual school. So kids normally go to their regular school, and they may take one or two courses to supplement their schedule. And that's the role that we've played for the last 15 years. We no longer do the workforce development stuff, and the capacity building activity with higher ed was really kind of a one-time initiative.
Yeah, because most of the universities in the state have their own online learning departments now and push them very aggressively, don't they?
Most definitely, yeah. You know, our name is a little bit of a misnomer. Michigan Virtual University is not a university. We are a nonprofit corporation, and we operate the Michigan Virtual School, which is kind of our core division, if you will. And so this past school year that we just finished, we served around 20,000 students, primarily at the high school level, some middle school students, and just a wide range of offerings that kids took advantage of.
Now, what kind of schools do you work with? Is there a certain type of school? Do you work with more rural schools, more city schools? How does it lay out?
You know, it really is kind of an interesting cross-section. We have a number of young people who attend small rural schools, like in your neck of the woods, where having access to an advanced placement course or a world language course might be limited in terms of the offerings themselves. Just as an example, we have 20 advanced placement courses, and these are courses that kids take to prepare for the college board exam, which then allows them to earn credit at the college level without paying tuition. So that parents find that to be really attractive. And a lot of small rural school districts may only have 9, 10 kids that want to take AP Physics, and so the economies of scale just aren't there. We're able to set up a section of AP Physics and have 22 kids or 28 kids from literally 28 different high schools. So we tend to work with some kids who are the high achievers who are looking for those higher-end courses, but then we do a fair amount of kind of what we refer to as credit recovery, kid who maybe wasn't successful taking a course his freshman year or sophomore year and needs to take it as a condition of graduating from high school, and we provide really a second-chance opportunity. So we work with small rural school districts. We work with urban school districts. Last year, I think we worked with close to 500 school districts around the state.
Wow. So what school districts in our area? I know you're involved with Chassel to some extent. Do you work with others here?
We do, and I didn't print out a list before we got on the air, but I know that we have been very active with, in fact, I would suggest that many of the school districts in the Upper Peninsula, really probably before it became kind of a fad, and you think about where things were back in 2000, taking an online course was a fairly novel activity. But the districts in the Upper Peninsula, for the most part, began doing this not to be cutting edge and to be innovative. They really did it out of necessity. And so I would say collectively the schools in the Upper Peninsula have been some of the early adopters of using online learning. And we've had a close working relationship with the 7 intermediate school districts in the Upper Peninsula. They come together and work with us. Really, we cut one purchase order for the courses that are purchased UP-wide. And that makes a lot of sense from an administrative standpoint. So we've had a long-standing relationship there with schools in the Upper Peninsula.
Who does pay for these courses? Do the kids get charged eventually, or does this come from the school district budgets?
Well, a little bit of a mix. In the summertime, probably not unlike schools that might offer a summer school, there might be an expectation that mom and dad are going to actually pay the price of the online course. During the school year, the school districts are paying. In fact, last year, the governor and the legislature signed into law as part of the State School Aid Act a provision. We refer to it as 21F. It's Section 21F of the State School Aid Act. It allows every student in grades 6 through 12 to take up to 2 online courses in any given academic term as long as they have the consent of mom and dad. Now, there are some reasons that schools can block or deny that request. For instance, if a student wanted to take Algebra 2 online and they had already taken it face-to-face, the school district can block that request, and there are some other reasons. But if the student and mom and dad are making the request, and we're the seventh state to have this, we kind of refer to it as choice at the course level. The districts have that obligation to take part of their foundation allowance and pay for the course. We receive some appropriation support from the legislature, which helps us defray the cost of the courses that we offer to Michigan schools. But one of the things that 21F was intended to do was to really create an environment, a market, if you will, where literally any school district in the state of Michigan can design and develop an online course and then make it available to any other school district in the state of Michigan. And that's really exciting. Right now, if you go to mycourses.org, which is the statewide catalog, you're going to see around 40 school districts that have already put at least one title into the catalog, and there are around 2,000 titles that are out there. So we've already seen some pretty significant work just in the last 9 months or so since the law's gone into effect.
So there are actually now school districts, individual kind of client school districts, that are developing their own courses and posting them?
Exactly. And one of the things that we're doing, obviously we've had online courses to Michigan schools. We've been doing it. We've provided well over 150,000 online courses. We do online professional development, so teachers around the state that want to learn how to be a better math teacher, or maybe it's a compliance-type course, we offer those. But what we're trying to do is some capacity building, in essence, teach people how to fish. So if you can imagine a small school district that maybe has a rock star teacher who teaches, astronomy, and there's only 10, 12, 13 kids that want to take that course semester after semester, and it's one of those things that's on the bubble financially. The district is trying to figure out how they can continue to offer it. They may say, we're going to take this course, we're going to make it available online, we're going to train our teacher how to teach online, we're going to put it into the statewide catalog, we're going to market to kids statewide. If we can get another 15 or 8 kids from around the state to enroll in that course, now it becomes a sustainable offering that that small rural school district may have been thinking that they were going to have to eliminate because of no economies of scale.
So school districts actually in some way, shape, or form get compensated for this?
Well, if a district in the Copper Country decided to do the example that I just, put the astronomy course into the catalog, there's really no limit. If, let's just say that they had a teacher who could teach 4 sections of this, and there was that level of demand for an online astronomy course. I mean, you could have kids from Dowagiac and Three Rivers and, Mumford High School and Flint and Pontiac, wherever, who could enroll in those courses, and then the district in Copper Country would be receiving up to 1/12 of the foundation allowance for each one of those enrollments. They have the ability, the district offering the online course, to set the price. They can't set it at a price that would exceed 8.3% of the foundation allowance, which is around $600.
Is there a core of school districts at this point that might look at this and say, well, we have a potential profit center here if we can develop our own courses?
I don't know of anybody who's really looking at it as a profit center, but I think the example that I cited where, you have a course that looks like it's going to be put on the chopping block, I think this now gives a district, especially a small rural district that has, sparsely populated community that they're serving, a chance to bring more kids into that learning environment, whereas before it was just about how many kids can you bus and how far can you bus them. Now we start to think about the strategy of moving the instruction instead of moving the student. And it really does open up the world to a very, very different delivery model, and it may allow some of our districts to think about this in an entrepreneurial way, that they're able to just simply offer more to their students than they were otherwise.
Jamie Fitzpatrick is my guest. He is the president and CEO of Michigan Virtual University that works with schools across the state to develop online learning programs. Now, is this just for public schools, or are private school students eligible to get involved in this? What about homeschooled kids?
Yeah, I know we serve, the Michigan Virtual School has served homeschool students from the very beginning. And with regards to this provision that kids can take an online course and the local district is required to pay for it, homeschool students and students who attend non-public schools can benefit as long as the courses that they're accessing are considered non-core. So a lot of your parochial schools, as an example, will work in partnership with the local public school for things like band and choir, maybe even some upper-level math, some things that are not considered core, and sometimes that's the public school teacher going to the non-public school to teach the course. So there's a variety of arrangements for those kinds of situations, and in those cases, those students who attend a non-public school school or a homeschool can take online courses and have the public school pay for it. They're actually able to claim those students when they file for their foundation allowance from the state.
Now, how does a course like this work? Is this a situation where the students all go to one place in the school and sit down and watch a basically kind of a live telecast on the computer of the course, or is this materials that have been prepared in advance that they can access at any time?
Todd, that is a great question, because one of the most common misconceptions of parents who've never had a chance to experience an online course think that if, let's just say, you and I were enrolled in an AP World History course, that and you go to Castle High School and I go to Three Rivers High School, downstate, that we're going to be logging in at 8:15 at the exact same time with our peers in that class, and we're going to be watching an instructor live. And we will make use, in our online courses, we will make use of video clips, we'll make use of audio files, simulations, graphics. We work with the publishing industry, so we'll oftentimes have an electronic copy of the textbook that would normally be used in the class if we were being taught in a face-to-face setting. But most of the activity that's taking place is not happening real-time, so you might be taking your class and interacting with it third hour. I might be doing it fifth hour. Other students may be doing it before school or after school. So it's a real mix, but it's with the exception of some world language activities where the kids have a microphone and a headset and they're doing some practicing of their language, we typically don't have real-time interaction.
So if I'm working on my course material, maybe I'm watching a video clip of a teacher who's explaining astronomy to me, and I have a question, how do I get that answered?
So within that learning environment, we call it a learning management system, or an LMS. That's the password-protected environment on the Internet where you go and log in. You can submit homework assignments, take quizzes. There are opportunities for you to send private messages to your instructor. There's typically a response time. It's one of the challenges for students taking an online course is that you typically are not going to get that instant feedback. And it takes somebody who can be a natural problem solver. Really, what we're talking about are 21st century learning skills. I think that was why, back in 2006, the governor and the legislature, when they revamped the high school graduation requirements, said, we believe before every kid can graduate from high school, they need to have an online learning experience. And last year in the United States, almost 40% of our college students nationwide took at least one online course. And if you look at the way education and training is being delivered in the workplace, much of it is now being delivered in non-classroom environments. So it's great that we give the kid in the Upper Peninsula a chance to take Mandarin Chinese, but I think more importantly, the real skill is we're helping them learn how to learn in an environment that they're going to need to be proficient in the rest of their lives.
How do you enforce some kind of accountability in an online course? I mean, you give me the test, I go over to my computer, I Google the answers, I fill them all in, and by golly, I've got an A.
Yeah, I would be lying if I said it's not a challenge. It is a challenge, and I think we've had those challenges in brick-and-mortar classrooms for as long as we've had schools. So it's just simply a different set of challenges. If you were in a writing class and you submitted an essay, our instructors will take that written text and we'll run it through a service that we pay for that checks it against Internet content. And so within literally 30 seconds, we can tell whether or not you lifted that content from the Internet. A lot of our high-stakes exams that are offered online, the students can't access that password-protected environment. They can't get to that test until a local educator, we call them the mentor, unlocks it for them. So we are constantly doing things to try to get at the temptations that are there for students to cheat or not be as honest as they should or could be.
Kind of leads into my next question that I had here as well. How do you integrate with the local school district? What kind of support do you expect from that school district when students sign up for these classes?
A great question, Todd. One of the things that school districts are required to do under this 21F legislation is make available a local mentor. That mentor does not have to be a certified teacher. It could be a parapro. I guess technically it could be a parent volunteer, but somebody who's helping to be the ears and eyes for the student. And what a lot of schools are doing is they're creating lab environments. And a group of students might go into that lab in third hour, and there might be 25 students in the lab, and there's an educator there or a volunteer or a parapro. And they're the connection point for our online instructors or for anybody else who's delivering online courses. And so if our online instructor's trying to reach Todd in AP history and can't reach him after a couple of days, our instructor would send a note to your mentor locally and say, hey, Todd hasn't logged on for a couple of days. You know, what's going on? Maybe the student, you know, needs a kick in the pants. And that local mentor provides substantial, we call them wraparound support services to help with the technology issues. They don't have to be qualified in the content area where the student is taking the course, but they're there as a human resource to help the students with issues that they might have.
Sure, and to make sure that the students stay on task, I would assume, at least to some level.
Exactly, and proctor exams and quizzes and things like that.
So do these courses basically stretch out over the length of, say, a standard school semester, or are these classes that kids can go through at their own pace?
We do give students some flexibility to complete the courses earlier than they might otherwise. If you and I were both at a traditional high school and we were taking Algebra 1, odds are we're going to go through the course together pretty much at the same speed. And, you know, at the end of the marking period, we're going to be done. We're going to all kind of end at the same time. Because of some just practical calendaring issues, we give a little bit of flexibility for when students start the course, but we do have hard end dates just because schools need report cards. And what we do is at the end of a student taking an online course, we'll issue a percentage score to the home district. Let's just say we set an 89%. The home district will take that, translate it into a letter grade for transcripting purposes, and then assign the credit value. Some school districts will wait, for an example, an advanced placement course. They'll give it more weight. But our relationship with schools has really been one of trying to be a partner. We're not trying to go after the foundational allowance, if you will, and compete with schools. We're trying to be a good partner in helping them better serve the students with a variety of online courses that may reflect content areas that they just simply can't offer.
Jamie Fitzpatrick is my guest. He is the president and CEO of Michigan Virtual University. How do teachers in local schools react to this, and do they in any way view this as a threat?
You know, I think that there are some that view online learning as a threat. I'll be honest with you. When we started the virtual school 15 years ago, there were a lot of, I've worked in the education sector for a long time, and there were a lot of people who came forth and said, Jamie, you're going to harm public education and you're going to devalue the role of a public school teacher. And by kind of depersonalizing education, turn kids into, I guess, kind of like little learning robots and diminish the socialization process. And here's what we found, Todd. We have teachers that work for us on a part-time contractual basis that are scattered all over the state of Michigan, including in the Upper Peninsula, who teach for us. And we come together as a group in August for a two-day in-service. And I ask, just about every year, I ask, why do you teach? Because these are people who are successful classroom teachers. Why do you teach online? And probably the number one answer that I get is I like to teach online because I get to know my virtual students oftentimes better than kids in my own physical classroom. So there's something about this virtual that we're still learning. We're in the infancy of this profession. I think most teachers, once they get into it and they see the power of it, it actually starts to transform the way they deliver instruction in their face-to-face classroom environments.
Have they developed virtual spitballs yet that they can throw at teachers?
No, but I will tell you, we've had a snow day in 15 years of virtual school, and we've never had a fight in the cafeteria. So
we've taken care of a few problems in the public school district, at least in this. There has been probably for the last century in the United States, this kind of school experience, it's been a common experience to all of the kids, or at least most of them, that go through school. You start in kindergarten together, you go through elementary school, middle school, you go through high school together, you take the same courses at the same level, you graduate at the same time, you take part in the high school sports activities and the clubs and things like that that are offered in high schools. My 40th class reunion is coming up in just a few days, and I was thinking about that. We have these common experiences. Now we have situations developing where kids can take local community college courses while they're in high school. They can take these online courses while they're in high school. Are we at some point losing some of the traditional feeling of high school because of this?
Well, I think the traditions that you referenced are extremely cemented in our in the kind of the fabric of our society. So I don't see them slipping away. But I will be honest with you. To think that we all can learn Algebra 1 at the same speed. I mean, we know enough about brain research to know that not everybody learns at the same pace or in the same format equally well. And I'm not suggesting that online learning is better than face-to-face. And in fact, I don't think that's the real question, because we know online learning is effective. It's trying to figure out what learning environment is the most conducive to Todd versus Jamie, and then how do we accelerate offering those kinds of programs and services to best meet individual student needs. So I think we'll continue, but I think the beauty of the Internet, we had a fourth grader 3 years ago who took a geometry class. Mom was an engineer, dad was an executive with the auto industry, and they didn't feel safe having that fourth grader physically go to the high school during the day and interact with high school students in a geometry class. So this notion of being able to go farther, faster, we know the price of higher ed just continues to escalate. The fact that we could allow kids, while they're still in high school, to take college-level courses and start to chip away at some of that huge debt that many kids are, and their families are collecting. I think we're getting more flexibility and allowing kids to take paths that best meet their needs. And, whether that means they're done with high school in 11th grade, I don't see the downside of that, to be perfectly honest with you.
Okay. Where do you think we'll be with this in 5 years, 10 years?
Well, I made reference in the beginning of the interview that we're a supplemental provider. So the students that we serve attend a local school or a non-public school, or they're being homeschooled, and we serve a small portion of their educational experience. But there are these things called cyber schools, and those are charter schools, so they're public entities. And those students are allowed to attend a cyber school and receive 100% of their education online. So that's a trend that is starting to move the country, and we've had cyber schools here in place since 2009. I'm a little bit of a skeptic as to how many students are actually going to flourish in a 100% online learning environment, because I really do believe that socialization process is critical. I think what we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years is a significant push towards what I'll refer to as blended learning, where the students are receiving some of their educational experiences online and some of them face-to-face. Many of those experiences will look like they did 20 years ago, but many of them, even within a course, will have some blend, so that it's not all online and not all face-to-face, but it's a mixture. And that mixture will be largely dependent on what's best for that individual student.
Of course, you are the president and CEO of Michigan Virtual University. That means you obviously have a web presence. If people would like to look over what you offer, find out more about Michigan Virtual University, how do they find you online, Jamie?
Todd, our web address is miVU.org.
miVU.org. That's simple enough. Okay. Jamie, thank you so much. I really appreciate the information. Best wishes. I know you're working with some districts here in the Copper Country, and hope that things continue to grow and develop for you and for the students who work with your programs.
Well, thank you so much.
Jamie Fitzpatrick, the president and CEO of Michigan Virtual University, here on Copper Country Today. We are brought to you in part by members of the Copper Country Education Association and the Copper Country Veterinary Clinic. You can also access our interviews online by going to the Copper Country Today page at KeweenawReport.com. Sam Ali will be talking with the producers of the movie Superior, which has been filming in our area. That is just ahead on Copper Country Today.